You're listening to the Hog Sports Network Daily Podcast. Now, here's your host, Matt Jones.
Today on the podcast, Ben Portnoy from the Sports Business Journal joins us to talk about Madni Amaliyava, NIL contracts, the House settlement, and much more going on in this turbulent time in college sports. Also, Ethan Westerman will be in studio with me. We'll talk about the Razorbacks' win over Little Rock last night at Baumwalker Stadium and look a little bit ahead to the NFL draft that begins tomorrow. Which Razorbacks are really in a position to be taken this week in the NFL draft? But first, a word from Kendall King.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design, with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
We continue to talk about Madni Amaliyava today and his transfer away from Arkansas. Ben Portnoy from the Sports Business Journal joins us. If you didn't see this yesterday, Hunter Yurecek, he put out a statement on social media that did not specifically address what's going on with Madni Amaliyava, but I think most people could put two and two together and really see that this was probably what he was talking about. This is the quote. He said, "I've spoken with the leadership team at Arkansas Edge, expressed my support in their pursuit to enforce their rights under any agreement violated by our student athletes moving forward." He went on to say, "We appreciate Edge's investment in our student athletes and acknowledge the enforcement of these agreements as vital in our new world of college athletics. We look forward to continued dialogue with all parties in resolving these matters." Ben, when you hear that, I mean, again, he didn't mention the Madni Amaliyava situation directly, but I mean, I think we all know that a day after this happens, that this is what he is addressing. Is this, because I saw a lot of, you know, national reporters kind of latch on to this, is it really that unprecedented that an AD is coming out and maybe defending his collective, his school, for the athletes that have left early the way that Amaliyava did?
Yeah, you know, I think, look, I would say this with both the Madden situation and Nico as well, right? Like, these are kind of the most probably publicly played out situations of this sort of ilk, but these things happen all the time. And I think they have been happening for basically going on 3 years. And I think that these have just, again, played out really publicly. So you're seeing maybe the average fan or the average person is seeing more maybe behind the curtain than they'd seen previously as far as how these things go. But like a kid asking for a raise in the off season or a school not wanting to match an offer or whatever, like these things happen truly like almost every day in the off season and especially in portal season. Now, so to your point, like, is this a massive, massive story? Like, yes, it's been latched onto a little bit. But what I would say is that it certainly represents something that's a little bit bigger and more broad as far as like, you know, like, frankly, like, contracts actually being enforced. And I think that, you know, I think, at least for me and the way I've looked at this, and I think a lot of folks probably feel the same way, is that, let's use the Nico situation to start and then can kind of jump on Madden, is, like, if you're Nico in his camp, you are well within your right to say, hey, off season, I feel like I played well, I want a raise, this is what I feel like I want. As a team, Tennessee, you're also entitled to say, hey, we're good, we feel like we're paying you what you're entitled. If you don't think that's the case, Godspeed. Same thing kind of happens here with Madden, right? Where if you sign a contract, like, I think about it even in the simplest terms, right? Like, if you sign an apartment lease, like, that's a contract, right? Like, uh-huh. you're entitled to whatever that is. Like, if you break an apartment contract or apartment lease that's a year long and you leave after 6 months, probably going to be out some money for the remainder of the contract. And so kind of the same thing here. Certainly there's contingencies and like, look, I haven't seen Madden's contract word for word in front of me, but like, it's safe to assume like there's certainly, and I'm no lawyer, but I do think like, obviously there's contingencies that a lot of collectives have written around as far as like revenue sharing, the house settlement being put in place, et cetera. Like that creates a little bit of a sort of wonkier situation legally as far as like, can you put a contract in place that's basically contingent on certain things being passed and in place? Like, that creates a little bit of I guess, wiggle room, for lack of a better term. But I do think, again, like, a school enforcing a contract or a collective enforcing a contract or an athletic director saying, like, hey, we're going to enforce a contract, it, frankly, like, it makes sense. If you're the schools, you got to do something, right? Like, if an NFL team, like, if a guy wants out of his contract, there's a buyout involved. Same thing with coaches, etc. Like, we've seen this all the time. So I think is it completely crazy that Hunter Yurecek is out here saying, yes, we're going to enforce contracts? No. Is it unique in the sense of we haven't really seen this in college sports previously? Yes. And I think that's why you see it being sort of the bigger, I guess, story, I guess, quote unquote, than maybe it might actually be when you sort of look at it from a 10,000 foot view.
You know, and we're moving into the rev share era. I mean, almost certainly, and I want to talk to you more about the House settlement here in just a second, but it looks like we're moving into the rev share era later this year. Are we going to see a thing where players have two separate financial agreements with programs, like they have a rev share agreement with the university and they have these financial agreements with the collectives?
So you're seeing that right now in particular because, right, like, and I know a lot of folks, like, the financial piece of this is hard to understand and, like, their eyes probably glaze over, which, fair, it's complicated, very in the weeds, right? But I think, like, look, like, the super simple way to think about this is between now and July 1st, when, in theory, schools would be allowed to pay kids directly through revenue share, collectives have all this money that they got to get off their books, basically, or that they need to kind of dump, basically, because it's going to be under subject to more scrutiny, I would say, should this clearinghouse and the House settlement go through. So given that's the case, you see a lot of schools that are signing revenue share agreements of, like, what kids will get compensated once revenue sharing goes into effect. Mm-hmm. And then two, like, what their collective deal looks like for right now. Now that's this interim period. That's basically between now or, say, like, you know, the last couple of months and July 1. What we'll see post July 1, I think you will probably see a mix of things. Like, you'll still have your standard scholarship agreement, like you would have if you were an undergrad just enrolling at Arkansas or wherever, right? Like, you, if you have a scholarship, you sign up basically a contract that says, hey, these are what that, this is what that entails, right? Like, the normal paperwork that stays consistent. You'll have a revenue share agreement, which again is basically a contract that says, hey, and this is what athletics or the university is going to pay me as sort of my as this cut of whatever revenue we're bringing in, and the $20.5 million cap that's being laid out. And then again, yes, I think there will be NIL components to that with collectives, but I think, frankly, like, that's a little bit TBD because of what sort of purpose do collectives serve in this new realm, if only because, again, these deals are going to face a little more scrutiny as far as, like, is this just handing a kid $100,000 for three tweets, or is there, like, an actual marketing value to this? So, like, if a collective is setting up a brand deal with whatever, if an, you know, to put it in an Arkansas context, right? Like, if they're taking Arkansas's starting quarterback and saying, hey, you're going to be on Walmart's, you know, national advertisements for the rest of the year, and we're going to pay you $300,000 for that, right? Like, that may, like, that's kind of what we're looking at. Like, you're looking at real marketing deals. So I think that, as far as, like, what those agreements will look like, I think that's kind of what you'll see maybe closer to as far as, like, collective deals. But to actually answer your question, yes, there will be a couple of different sort of pieces of paper to sign here. And there's a lot of lawyers who are, you know, combing through all of these things.
Brandon Marcello at CBS, who I know you know, and he's a good friend of ours, used to work here at our company. He reported yesterday that at Arkansas, they've got language in these NIL deals that expects the players to reimburse 50% of the money remaining on their deal should they go to another team. He said that Arkansas's collective expects a six-figure buyout from Iam Aliava. Do you see a road in which this goes to court, or do you think that it's better for these two sides to figure this thing out before it gets into you know, litigation in the courtroom?
You know, I mean, look, I think it could go a million different ways, right? And again, like, I'm not a lawyer. Could you settle it? Sure. I'm not a lawyer, but I probably know enough to be dangerous. It's probably my bigger problem. But, you know, I think, look, like, there's a couple of avenues here. Like, certainly you could settle, and I think that probably makes a lot of sense. Like, realistically, do a collective and a kid really want to go into discovery and have all of this be public? Probably not, is my general assumption. That said, like, yeah, like, at some point, if you say, like, if it's a revenue sharing agreement and it's with the university and it's a little more, you know, not to say collectives are not above board. Certainly there are some collectives that are doing really great things and all of that. But, like, I think if it's, like, straight up with a university that's in theory, like, a little more again, kind of above board or clear cut on what they're doing. I think that makes a lot more sense probably to be taken to court in whatever capacity that is. Like, but I do think like at some point, like a school is going to sue a kid probably. And I think you're seeing it right now, kind of like the Madden I Maliava situation is part one, you know, the situation involving Wisconsin and Xavier Lucas, who transferred to Miami. That was kind of the first. Now, will Wisconsin sue the kid? We'll see. But I think that, you know, there's a real chance that could go to court and become an issue. So again, like, I think that, if you're the schools, it's kind of a way to cover yourself against kids leaving. And I think, like, that makes perfect sense. Now, again, how enforceable those contracts are, et cetera, like, that's legal piece that I'm not so sure about and probably don't have enough expertise to say. But I do think, like, are we going to get to a world where a kid gets sued by a school because they leave and they don't want to pay a buyout? Like, I mean, yeah, I think that's a fair assumption that that will happen, especially if you get to a point where some of this stuff is a little more, I guess, regulated or codified with the House settlement.
Yeah, you know, I think any of us who have been 18, 19, 20 years old, we all learn things the hard way, whether it be during tax season or, you know, whenever mom and dad aren't there to hold your hand through the process anymore. It feels to me like there probably are a lot of players in college sports right now, whether it be football, basketball, whatever, that maybe they're learning the hard way that, you know, what they've signed is maybe more enforceable than or maybe it's making things harder on them just to, you know, leave maybe than it used to be.
Yeah, I mean, let me tell you, Matt, when I was, whatever, 16 and I got my first paycheck and it was like, wait, what do you mean I don't get actually the number that I thought I'm getting, right? Like, that's not how that works, right? But no, I think that, you know, you're right. I think, like, yes, there's something to be said here. But I think, like, too, I think, look, all of this is a product of a system that has no regulation. And I think that, you know, you look at it with coach contracts, right? Like, there's certainly discussions and settlements where, like, say a coach gets fired and then they end up negotiating a lower buyout number for whatever reason. And, like, that stuff happens and is frankly pretty standard practice. We see it all the time in college sports or NFL or NBA, whatever. But I think that, like, when it comes to players and you look at the professional ranks, you have collective bargaining agreements that basically stipulate a lot of these things of, like, how you handle contract disputes, how things are resolved as far as buyouts, things like that, right? And in college sports, you don't have that. So we end up in the situation that we're in right now or that we're existing in, where there's kind of this, like, weird in-between where, you know, in theory, a school could sue, but they're not really sure how much the contract's going to hold up in court. The kid can leave, but does that, again, open them up to being sued potentially for back pay and things like that? So it creates, again, like, because there's no structure, we're seeing kids get stuck in these situations. And I think, frankly, like, and look, I get there's a lot of, like, fear mongering and things like that in this space about a lot of this stuff. But, like, look, like, you've got agents that are not necessarily certified in any capacity, right? Like, as some people have joked, as, you know, the analogy that someone's used that they gave to me, and I think is a really apt one, is that basically takes a cell phone and a Twitter account to be an NIL agent these days. Like, there's no actual certification process. And I think that because of that, like, again, like, you don't know what you're getting on that front. You don't know what kind of advice you're getting. And this is true for any 16, 17, 18-year-old. But again, it's putting kids in not necessarily the best situations. And I think that that's a harsh reality of some of this stuff. Now, is that the case with Madden? I don't know that that's necessarily the case. Like, not to speak to that necessarily. But I do think that it again, to your point, like, it does create a situation where kids may get burned. And I think that's unfortunate.
So it sounds like the House settlement, maybe end of this week, early next week, is probably going to be finalized in the Northern District of California, in the federal courtroom there. Are schools, you know, they've had however long to get ready for this. Do you think they are ready? And let's say this does get finalized in the next couple, three business days. What's the next step?
Yeah, I mean, look, like, most schools, and Arkansas included, and most schools in the SEC, Power Four, et cetera, like, have been operating under the assumption that this was going to be rubber stamped and go into effect July 1, whatever that looks like. So I think, you know, yes, schools are prepared for, in theory, what they think this is going to look like. But I think the question I have is, like, what does this actually mean? And I think, you know, I may have used this analogy with you before, but I think it makes a lot of sense. It's like, if you look at the House settlement, like, again, for folks that hear this legal stuff and think, hey, what does this all mean, right? Like, the simplest way to look at it is, like, if you have a bullet point list of, like, 10 things that you need to do to fix college sports, the House settlement probably knocks off, like, 3 or 4 of them. It's not a silver bullet. It's not going to, you know, fix the entire ecosystem. It's not the perfect fix. But it does, I think, lay out the groundwork to be able to say, hey, okay, in a year, 2 years, 5 years, whatever that is, whatever college sports looks like at that point, this gives us kind of like a baseline of how you could approach creating a structure for college sports. Now, I would say for me at least, and I think for most folks that you talk to, especially legally, like collective bargaining and employment status is kind of the big question that is not addressed in this. You know, collective bargaining being like everyone comes to the table, you draw up a contract and say, hey, these are the things we agree to, this is what we're going to do. But in order to do that under federal law, you have to be classified as an employee. Athletes are not technically employees of the universities they attend. So that creates a whole host of issues and is kind of a side door to a lot of this. And I think becomes the main problem, I guess, so to speak, moving forward. And if that's the case, like that, I think is where my eyes turn. If you're looking at the House settlement and kind of what comes next, I guess the other piece of it too, is like, just, is the House settlement going to hold up, right? Like, first of all, is it going to get approved, which I think most people think it will, but like, let's be real, like there's a world where it doesn't get approved. And that's, you know, one that I think a lot of folks don't necessarily want to address, but I do think is possible. But I think too, the other side of this would be, you know, do the things that the settlement spells out actually hold? So I mentioned the NIL clearinghouse where you're going to have Deloitte basically say, is this deal a thumbs up or a thumbs down? Is it fair market value? And let's be real, like the first time a kid gets an NIL deal that they give the thumbs down, probably going to get sued, or it's going to end up in court or whatever. It's going to get challenged. That's almost an inevitability. Second piece, like, can you actually sort of like create a governance structure to enforce those things? Like, these two things sort of correlate, but like, that's been the problem for 2 years, 3 years now, right? Is that like anytime the NCAA creates a rule, a state attorney's general jumps in, they sue, and then that they get an injunction, and that's that. And so I think that, you know, certainly like the NCAA has won a few cases of late related to like eligibility and guys wanting extra eligibility and things like that. I think that's probably a good thing as far as, you know, you're not going to have 8th, 9th, 10th year people playing college sports. But I think, again, like the flip side of that is like, are you going to be in a position to actually create rules and then subsequently enforce them? We'll see. Again, it's probably going to play out in a courtroom because pretty much everything in college sports plays out in a courtroom these days. And that's just what it is. But I think that's kind of where my eyes turn, at least as you look toward, you know, if, assuming the settlement is approved, that's kind of what I think comes next.
Let's assume it's approved. Is college football in a good place?
Oh man, how much time you got? I think there's two things I would say. I joke with, you know, folks about this all the time. It's like, despite our best efforts, I think there are still really good things that happen with college sports and college football. You know, you look at it, right? Like, viewership is up tenfold. It's as high as it's ever been. The sport is as popular as it's ever been. The money, frankly, is flowing in as much as it has ever been. At least to this capacity. Now, again, are we in a world where there is zero structure and you're basically running a league without any rules or regulations? Like, yeah, probably not the best situation for everyone involved, I would say. But I do think, again, like, college football is super, super popular. I think that, you know, and I think, Matt, you'd probably agree with this, like, look, like, people fall in love with college football because of the pageantry of it, because of the affinities they have for schools, the places they might have attended, the places they might have gone as kids to see games. That stuff still exists. Now, does it get, I don't know, not necessarily diminished, but do people, you know, get tired of all the perpetual change and transition and things like that with rosters and things like that? Like, yeah, that's exhausting. And I think, like, I think for fans, like, if you have some fans that say, hey, like, there's just too much change going on. Like, there's too much transition. Like, I can't keep up with who's on the team. Like, I'm going to sit this one out. I actually sympathize with that. And I get that. Like, it's hard to keep up, but I would say again, like, the reality is college football is super, super popular. There's huge media rights deals in place for that reason. There's a lot of money flowing into the space because of it. And frankly, like, it's giving kids opportunities in whatever capacity that might be, whether that's to, you know, chase professional sports, whether to earn money in college, whether it's to get a degree, et cetera, et cetera. Like, all of these things that have been bullet points for a long time. All of those things are still really good. Again, there's zero structure and there's a lot of things that are happening that are not great. But I do think, like, ultimately at the end of the day, like, college football as a entity is still really healthy and really popular. Structurally, it has some questions that need to be resolved.
I just wonder if there's going to be a little bit of a downriver effect. You know, things are we poisoning the water right now and we don't realize it until 5-10 years later. It's interesting. Always changing. Ben, we appreciate your time, though.
Yeah, thanks so much, man. No, this is great. Appreciate you guys having me.
All right, Ben Portnoy from the Sports Business Journal. You can read more of his work at sportsbusinessjournal.com. Ethan Westerman will be in studio with me when we come back. But first, another word from Kendall King.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over 4 decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
Hey, welcome back. I want to tell you about our friends at Bentonville Glass. They're committed, professional, and versatile, been serving their community since 1971. If you're looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas or looking for skilled craftsmanship, look no further than Bentonville Glass for all your glass market needs with the highest quality products. You can come by and see them now at 507 South Main in Bentonville or online at BentonvilleGlass.com. Also want to tell you can get the latest breaking news on all Razorback sports at WholeHogSports.com. Most in-depth source for all Razorback sports with analysis, latest in recruiting, unique stories on all your favorite teams. Subscribe today at WholeHogSports.com. Also hope you will subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on Apple by searching Whole Hog Sports, or you can find the video version of our podcast on our YouTube page. Just search Whole Hog Sports on YouTube. Arkansas baseball defeated Little Rock 10-0 in 7 innings last night at Baum Walker Stadium. Arkansas's 12th run rule victory this year. And really, there have been 14, although the 2 Missouri games in that doubleheader earlier this month, they don't technically count as run rule wins, even though Arkansas was up by 10 at the end of the top of the 7th inning, because those were 7-inning games. So technically, they're not run rules, but they would have been in any other any other scenario except for having a couple of 7-inning games and a doubleheader. So 14 times this year out of 42 games, that's 1/3 of their games, Ethan, Arkansas has been ahead by 10 or more runs after the 7th or the 8th inning.
Run ruling Razorbacks, that's a theme this year. Softball has set a program record for run rules. I guess baseball's probably right on track too, which run rules haven't been a thing.
They've obliterated the
record. Yeah, I'd say, because that's not been a thing until
about 3 years.
Yeah, so it's not like they're competing against a lot of years built up, but man, run rules have become popular this year among the teams, and you know, that's just a sign of obviously good hitting. Like, you don't get run rules unless you're putting up runs, and so got to have a good offense for that.
Well, there's a lot of, as it pertains to run rules, a lot of records that, you know, records or first time it's happened, things like that. That are occurring this year, like when Paul Maneri was here for South Carolina, Arkansas beat them 12-2 in game one, and he made the comment afterward, he goes, I don't know the last time I got run ruled. I don't know that it's ever happened. Well, he coached in the SEC before there was a run rule that was in place, and then last night LSU lost to Northwestern State. The boys from Natchitoches went down and won 13-3 in Baton Rouge, and it was the first time that LSU had ever been run ruled in a non-conference game.
Yeah, that's a tough look, too. I mean, it's just a midweek, but whenever it's an in-state team, I mean, that's a tough one.
Yeah, so you never know what you're going to get on Tuesday nights. Dave Van Horn talked about this last night. So Arkansas wins this game 10-0. It was interesting what he had to say about the team's focus going into this game. Have a listen.
Yeah, you have to be – these Tuesday wins the games between conference, and then we, you know – crazy thing about this, you know, the way we travel and different things, and we're telling guys to pack their bags, bring their bags today so they can get on a bus that's dead headed to Florida when we're supposed to concentrate on playing today and tomorrow. But we're packing our bag to go to Florida. So I give our team a lot of credit for what they did tonight. because they stayed focused, they took care of business, and all their bags for Florida are piled outside our locker room. The bus has probably already picked them up and are on their way now. I mean, there's a lot that goes on behind the scene that people don't know. But I appreciate that we get to fly to Florida.
So Dave Van Horn, after Arkansas playing Little Rock. For those who don't know, a lot of times when the team, or I guess maybe every time when the team flies to an away game, they will send the bus ahead of the team with equipment, gear, things like that, and then the bus will meet them at the airport when they get there. And obviously Gainesville, such a long drive from here, that bus, I guess it headed out last night or was heading out early this morning. So that's what he means by that. But it's a good point that he makes that you ask the players to keep their attention on the game at hand, and yet you're having to ask them to do things just because, scheduling, whatever, the quick turnaround, that forces them to maybe look ahead a little bit. It is an interesting dynamic there.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't know that baseball did an equipment truck like that. I knew I stay up in Rogers where half the football teams that come and play Arkansas will play, and I know that those buses get there early in the week, but football, it's such a big roster and so much equipment. I didn't know that baseball kind of had a similar deal where they sent a truck ahead of time, but that is tough because it's quite literally you have to be thinking about what you need for the weekend while you're trying to get back on track in a baseball, little two-game series against a team that's playing pretty well.
I don't know if this is true, but something I've heard before, and I've never verified with anyone who, is actually part of that, but one of the things I've heard is that they send the equipment like that because it helps reduce the weight of the aircraft. And, obviously then you can use smaller aircrafts whenever you're flying commercial to these away games. So, I don't know what to say about the game last night other than I just thought Arkansas came out, played well, didn't make mistakes, and then you look at Little Rock, they're kicking the ball all over the field, five errors. They had three during the third inning. They had another one during the second inning that led to a run. Arkansas got 11 hits, pitched well, only gave up three hits, got a good start from Tate McGuire. Dylan Carter came in, gave him a dominant inning the way he's been doing here of late. Carson Wiggins came in, and, he looked phenomenal, three strikeouts and 13 pitches. They beat Little Rock, who, by the way, Little Rock beat Ole Miss last Tuesday, so they're a team that's capable of beating quality teams on their home field. They beat them in a really sound way.
Yeah, so last night I was getting my steps in yesterday. The weather is great. I was going and getting my steps in, but I tuned into the baseball game for like three different short periods. And the three things that I got to see last night, I saw a Brent Iredale home run. I tuned in just in time for that. I tuned in for an in-the-park home run I was watching.
Well, it wasn't inside the park. It was a triple and an error.
Well, same thing in my book. He scored. You don't see that every day. And then I tuned in near the very, very end. I saw Carson Wiggins pitching, and oh my goodness, he's impressive.
Well, he took a little something off last night. I mean, the radar gun in the park, I think it was like 96, 98 fastball. Still. Dave was asked about him afterward, and he said that, if you went and asked, he said that Carson Wiggins has got such an easy delivery. He said, if I went and told Carson, hey, I'm going to buy you a new truck, if you can hit triple digits, he'd hit triple digits last night. So,
yeah, it's just funny. It's like I tuned in. I guess, that's a marker of a pretty just sound win is whenever there were the three portions of the game that I was kind of tuned in for. I listened to it on the radio a little bit too, but the portions that I saw just were dominance, dominant plays. It's just I tuned in at the right time, but you win like that, and there's probably a whole lot of highlights.
Yeah, so again, there's not a whole lot to talk about and dissect from this particular game. I did ask Dave Van Horn afterward, though, because after they played Texas A&M last weekend in the doubleheader, ask him, was your team tired? They had played seven games in 8 days at that point, and then obviously had played A&M in such a short window due to the forecast the next day. And he said, yeah, they were tired. You could see it on the field. And so I asked him last night, did you see a difference in your team after they'd had a couple of days to rest? And this is what he had to say.
A lot more. Just, the human body, the human mind, it can only take so much. And when we had that little rain delay, it it was hard to get it going again a little bit, as tired as they were. I know how tired I was. I know how tired the coaches were. So I know the players are tired, more tired than that. They play and run and hit and do all the other stuff. But, you know, we should have played that game earlier. We should have started at 12. But that's another story. I don't want to get into it.
I know how tired a certain sports writer was, at least mentally fatigued, after the doubleheader. Kind of interesting what he had to say there about he wanted to start the doubleheader at noon last Friday. You know, obviously, he said he didn't want to talk any more about it. But somebody asked me about that this morning, and I said, you know, there's a lot of people who have a say in when these games get played. And, you know, this is one of those weekends where you kind of make your money for baseball. The weekends when you got a high-profile opponent coming in, and obviously it was going to be the spring football weekend, and that, you know, it led to more ticket sales. I suspect, don't know this for sure, but I suspect that, you know, this is probably a decision that was made at the administrative level that said, hey, let's push this back to be able to get as many people in the ballpark as we possibly can and still get two games played within a window that's, you know, at a fairly acceptable time.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a coulda, woulda, shoulda now. It was a weird, just the way that everything played out, it made for a very strange weekend. Just like, it was supposed to be the whatever they call it. They call it a WooPig weekend or something.
The WooPig weekend. I think it was three O's.
Yeah, and I had the previous two or three years done the Triple Crown of going to softball, spring football, and then I've gone to baseball. I don't know. I'm not at baseball games very often, but for some reason this weekend I had done for like two or three years in a row.
Came for the free food.
The WooPig weekend was a lot of rain this year.
Turned into the Wet Pig weekend.
Yeah, I was about to say, it was a quiet weekend, a strange one. It just felt like, it was just off. You don't get weekends like that. And it you know, coulda, woulda, shoulda, they could have played a game on Saturday, let's be real, during a portion of the day. But you know you're going off forecasts and stuff, and now it's, I guess, with this situation of wish they could have played at noon on Friday, it's water under the bridge now.
Bubba and I talked about this a couple of days ago. The lightning delay in the finale against A&M, it just felt like it sucked all of the adrenaline out of the baseball players. It was like they were, you know, they were in the game, they were responding. A&M gets a home run, they come back, they get a double and a single to start the next inning, and it's a 3-2 game. They got their best relief pitcher right now, Aidan Jimenez, on the mound, but then you have the lightning delay, you got to take Jimenez out of the game, and it just felt like it just took everything out of the players. And, you know, if you started 2 hours earlier, you don't have the lightning delay, you wonder how that might have gone differently.
Yeah, I mean, of all sports, like, I mean, you can't put a price tag on momentum and the feeling of just like, if you can sense another team getting a little bit tense, like, you know that you're threatening, and then you take a long pause and it gives the other team time to, number one, you're the adrenaline isn't rushing anymore for you, of like you're making your push or whatever, and the other team has it time to just kind of like come to terms with the situation, and it's not as like much reaction in the moment of trying to get out of a jam or get out of whatever. I mean, that's so tough whenever rain or something does that. I mean, last year I remember the softball team played in an SEC tournament game against Missouri, and the exact same type of thing happened. It got kept on getting, like, they were making their push, and they had, I think, tied the game, or maybe they had just fallen behind by a run, but they were right in it, and then they eventually were like, all right, we're gonna have to restart this game at like 8 or 9 a.m. tomorrow, and it just was a clunker. Like, I mean, the next morning it just wasn't the same game. It's just, it completely changes how things are going.
I think anytime you have a delay, it benefits the road team. It takes the, because anytime you have a delay, you are guaranteed to lose a portion of the people who were in the stands. That's just how it is. And, you know, Arkansas totally lost its home field advantage in the final few innings of that game. One of the big developments that occurred or has occurred here in the last few days, and we picked up on this last night, is that Hunter Dietz is available to pitch for the Razorbacks. He might make his season debut today against Little Rock. The game's at 5. It's going to be on the SEC Network tonight. Dietz, left-handed pitcher. He's classified as a redshirt freshman, got a medical redshirt last year. Only pitched 2 times in games last year. Pitched against LSU in a late March series, and then he pitched against San Jose State early last April. He's a player who's been dealing with a bone issue in his arm. And somehow it's affected, or somehow it's related to a stress fracture that he's had in his arm. And so, or maybe up, you know, more near the elbow. I think it's been described to me that it's the ulna bone, which is that long bone that runs down, you know, your arm. And so it's something that has kept him out of games for quite some time. But this is a pitcher who was really, really highly touted out of high school. I think he was like the number 50-60 draft prospect in his class. It was a top 100 prospect overall. Matt Hobbs told me before, he said, I expected that I would see Hunter Dietz pitching in a Boston Red Sox uniform before I ever saw him in a Razorback uniform. So they were pleasantly surprised when they got both Dietz and Gabe Gackel to campus out of that signing class. Dietz, we haven't seen him pitch in games a whole lot, like I said, but we did get to see him in the fall of 2023 when they thought he was the most dominant pitcher in their inter-squad scrimmages. Now, keep in mind, Hagen Smith, that was the year before his National Pitcher of the Year. They held Hagen out. I think they let Hagen face like two or three batters that entire fall because they knew what they had there with him. They were, you know, kind of holding him back a little bit. But Dietz, if they can get him back to the level that he pitched a couple of falls ago, this is a left-handed pitcher who the sky is the limit for him. I mean, there's still a lot of great draft hope for him, you know, pro prospect hope for him. And this is what Dave Van Horn had to say last night about getting Hunter Dietz back available for this pitching staff.
Yeah, his velocity got up his last outing. He was on the 30-man roster this past weekend. I guess that slipped by a lot of people because I've had like three guys ask me if he was going to pitch in the last couple of days. And my comment was, well, he was available to pitch on the weekend because of what he did. I think it was either Monday or Tuesday when we were inside. I think it was Monday, and he threw. He threw really well, best he's thrown. So I'm hoping we can get him on the mound tomorrow. I mean, we're going to try to win the game, and he can help us win the game. But there's other guys as well. But yeah, he's ready to go. Is he, you know, two falls ago that good? Not yet. But hopefully he'll get back, and he could really help us.
Arkansas has been down to two left-handed relief pitchers for the last few weeks, with Parker Coyle being out because you got Zach Root and Landon Meidelshees in the starting rotation. Now they think Parker Coyle is going to be back within the next probably couple, 3 weeks by the end of the regular season. You add Hunter Dietz in there. I don't know what kind of pitchers either of these guys are going to be when they first come back. I'm sure there's going to be a build-up, a ramp-up that has to occur, but I think the Razorbacks have really got to like where things are trending with their pitching staff. Gabe Gackel looked really good out of the bullpen the other day. They get Gage Wood back the other day, and now he'll continue his build up here for the next handful of weeks. You get Coyle, you get Dietz. This could be a stronger bullpen by the time the Razorbacks get to the postseason than what we're seeing right now. And the bullpen has been pitching pretty well. I mean, that's been the strength of the pitching staff, has been what the relief pitchers have been doing, at least on the weekend. Going back to Dietz, though, and that fall that he had 2 years ago in the fall of 23, I asked Tate McGuire, who's Arkansas starting pitcher last night, about that. Tate came in with Hunter as part of that signing class in 2023, and I asked him what his recollections were of Hunter Dietz during the fall of 2023, and this is what he had to say.
I mean, the whole fall, I think he went out of the stretch maybe twice, the whole fall, which was pretty impressive. Just throwing a lot of stuff for strikes, a lot of stuff for swings and misses. And, I mean, I think you'll see that version of him very soon.
Only went out of the stretch twice, which means that maybe he only had base runners twice the entire fall.
It's crazy. I mean, this is unheard of that I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, with the base team, it seems like their pitching staff has the potential to just get stronger as the year's going, just with how things are shaking up with who you get back and whatnot. Usually I feel like it's the opposite, where mm-hmm. you start kind of losing some of your pitching and you're really fighting that battle of attrition. It seems like they're almost pulling like what happened with basketball in the NCAA tournament, where it's like, oh, are you gaining your guys back? Does it make you stronger? I mean, who knows if they come back and they pitch the way that they're capable of, or if Dietz does, but it's, you still have talent that has a chance to make you better. And I think that that's something that, you know, if as the season progresses, you don't always say that.
They got to stay healthy in other places. But right now, just based on the here and now, it looks encouraging for what's going on with the pitching staff. Arkansas right now, just one season-ending injury that they've suffered during the season, and that was to Nolan Sousa with his shoulder against Georgia. All right, moving on. NFL draft begins tomorrow. We're going to talk about a little bit right now because Bubba Carpenter is going to be in studio tomorrow, and we'll talk nothing but baseball during that podcast. Razorbacks on night one in the first round, nobody's going to get picked. But night two, maybe Landon Jackson in the second or the third round. And then certainly by day three, I think there's four or five players that are going to be in consideration to get picked this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, I've been reading the NFL. You know, NFL.com does these like prospect profiles. Landon Jackson right now, they're projecting him to be a second rounder. These are always so interesting to me to read because of how technical they get with a lot of these prospects. Like Landon Jackson, they're talking about his unorthodox, like they're trying to come up with, you know, like maybe the downsides to these players. And with him, they're talking about his unorthodox movements and his lack of bend that hinders his anchor. And I'm like, man, y'all are looking at some things that I just, you know, I personally never noticed Landon Jackson like.
You ever noticed his anchor?
Never noticed him, his anchor and him not being super bendy. But now that I think about it, I'm like, you're probably onto something, like just thinking about the way he plays. It's just these are so interesting to read because they are, I mean, they get into it. But, I mean, they like how high energy he is, that they say he's long and he's urgent and fighting his way past the man in front of him. I mean, yeah. and this, what I'm talking about, they're talking about his unorthodox movement. This was the final sentence. It will look gawky at times, but Jackson seems to be growing into his frame and possesses the traits and motor to make it as a future starter on the edge. So I guess Landon Jackson looks gawky out there, but he's a high-energy guy. Projected to be a second rounder right now. Like you said, could probably maybe be a third rounder. I mean, there's like a projection or two out there that has him late first round, but I don't think that's likely.
Does that surprise you, second-round draft grade for Landon Jackson? Because physically, I see it. I see it. I mean, you look at him, he's 6'7", you know, I don't know that he's that fast. I think that, you know, I don't see him being this great pass rusher in the NFL because I never thought he was a great pass rusher in college. He had, 12 sacks, 12 and a half sacks over the last 2 years, and 3.5 of those came in one game against a freshman tackle at Alabama. And I mean, anytime you have a big game against Alabama, that's going to raise your draft stock. I understand that. But you look at the other 22, 21, 23 games that he played in, I just never saw what I thought was a big-time draft prospect.
Yeah,
it's interesting because I understand he had the hype. I just never saw it.
Yeah, I think people are banking on that he's really good in run against the run, and they want him to develop into a better pass rusher, I guess. But yeah, it's funny because you're reading like his strengths, and literally one of the bullet points on strengths is wrecked Alabama's protection in 2023 with spectacular performance. Like that was the game that really put him on the radar. He's really tested well with all the stuff, like, you know, between the combine and what else. Like he's raised his stock, I think, from all those type of things. I know his vertical was apparently crazy at the combine. He's one of those guys that I think it's just the upside that people are excited about. But yeah, I never in college got the sense he was just some dominant pass rusher, but he was pretty good against the run, and he had his games where he was good rushing the passer. But I guess they're looking at him right now as a round two guy.
So day two for Landon Jackson, that's what the projections say. Day three guys that we could see going for Arkansas, Andrew Armstrong, Isaac Tesla, Jaquindon Jackson, Eric Gregory.
Yeah, it's funny because out of these profiles, actually the player that's projected to be the second pick for Arkansas is Isaac Tesla, who he talked about a guy who, you know, has freakish testing stuff just as far as the combine and whatnot. I think people just love his athleticism and whatnot. He's projected a round four or five pick by NFL.com. Andrew Armstrong is projected round six. They have Eric Gregory as either round seven or a free agent, and then they have Jaquindon Jackson as a priority free agent. So they kind of in order have it: Tesla, Armstrong, Gregory, Jaquindon Jackson as far as where they think they'll get picked. But things can always change. I mean, you never – I feel like every single draft that happens, there's a guy that you're like, whoa, didn't see that one coming, or didn't – good or bad, like didn't see him getting picked that high or didn't see him getting picked. But Yeah, this is Tesla. I mean, they're just in love with his all of his testing.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the WAR. It's some stands for something that has to deal with testing, and he had like the highest one.
It's not the same. It's not the same as WAR in baseball.
Yeah, I don't think it is. It's not that. All I know is Isaac Tesla had like the best one that they've seen in a prospect in like a very long time, and it's all these measurables, and you know. He's an athletic dude. I guess that's the upside there is just, and I mean, Arkansas fans saw it this year. Whenever he got his opportunities, he was one of those guys at the end of the year. You're like, why didn't we see you more at the beginning? Because he ended up, I think, either tied or with the lead on the team in touchdowns. Like, and he was nowhere near the amount of like targets as everybody else. So he's a guy who can make big plays. I mean, Andrew Armstrong being projected sixth round. I don't know, seems kind of low for me for a guy who led the SEC in receiving yards, but the touchdown production wasn't there.
I think the scouts are also worried about his speed.
Yeah, well.
He ran a 4.5 something at the combine.
He did the 40 again at the Arkansas Pro Day. I know that to try and get that up. And I think that for him, it's more or less, yeah, he's got to be able to prove himself again. I mean, but that's been his entire career. He had to prove himself to get a spot at Texas A&M Commerce, which is now East Texas A&M. He had to prove himself to just get a spot there. Then he had a good showing at that level. Then proved himself at Arkansas. It's just, I think that for him, this is probably a pretty comfortable spot where he's not freaking out about being a round six projection.
With Armstrong, you know, like we've seen what an elite receiver looks like at Arkansas, and I'm thinking of Treylon Burks because he was a first round pick, right?
Yeah.
And so you've seen that, and so with Armstrong, he was a good receiver for Arkansas, but he's not Treylon Burks, right? I mean, like, you can watch the two of them play and you can really see that, you know, just physically he's just not in that category. And that's not a knock on him. It's there are not a lot of receivers who do look like that. You know, with Armstrong, I feel like it's going to just take a team that really likes him to get drafted, because I feel like with Armstrong, there's probably 20, 25, 30 other receivers who are very comparable to him in this draft. So I feel like with him, it's going to come down to, like I said, a team that likes him, not only what he's done on the field, but probably how he's performed in the interviews too.
Yeah. Well, and for him, I mean, he's a guy that he wins a lot of the 50. I mean, he goes up and gets it if there's a ball in his area. He's not a guy who's dropping passes, and that stands out to me. You don't go through the SEC and lead the league in receiving yards and not be a pretty dang good receiver. He did get a whole lot of targets, but at the same time, I mean, you had games like they don't win against Tennessee without him making that spectacular grab down the sideline that set up a score. Against Missouri, he gave him a real shot to win in that snow game where you don't really think of throwing the ball around like that. He's one of those guys that I just think, yeah, you don't really know what you're going to get, but there's enough there that somebody will take a shot on him, I think. And then, yeah, Jaquinin Jackson, for him, I feel like it's the ankle, just the injury history that probably makes people hesitant with him, because whenever he was healthy, he was great for Arkansas, but, I mean, he wasn't healthy all the time. And then Eric Gregory, I mean, he was a really rare one at Arkansas. You saw a guy for 6 years at Arkansas, which, how many players are those? There's a lot of guys who've played for 6 years, but how about the same program? And he was one that just got better and better, I feel like, as his career went on. But those are kind of the guys right now. I mean, they're the ones who went to the combine. We'll be curious to see if, you know, who goes after Landon Jackson. I mean, he's the obvious first one that's going to get picked. But then these other guys, we'll be curious to see where they land.
NFL draft tomorrow night, first round, second and third round will be Friday night. And then on Saturday, you'll have the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh rounds. You looking forward to it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, who doesn't look forward to sitting and watching the names go by for hours?
I love the NFL draft.
Yeah, I was being very sarcastic with mine. I'm glad that you like it. But
my son loves it. He's been talking about this for, I don't know, probably 11 months. Dad, when's the next NFL draft? Can I stay up and watch the picks?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Fortunately, we're Cowboys fans, so as long as they don't... And I don't put anything past the Jones family, but as long as they don't push that 12th pick, you know, give away that 12th pick to go back in the first round, maybe Jack can get to bed at a decent time.
Yeah, I get bored after the first, you know. I do like when when the picks start coming a little bit faster, I like it, because I get bored at the beginning whenever it's taking long to get to the next one, and then I get bored whenever it's like, that point in the draft where you don't really care.
I care about all of them.
I don't.
Jack did ask me, he goes, Dad, he goes, if the Cowboys win the Super Bowl, can I stay up and watch their pick in the NFL draft? I said, Jack, I don't think you're going to have to worry about that one.
Yeah.
I don't think that they're going to be picking 32nd anytime.
Yeah.
Anytime soon. I love it. And I also like how they've changed the format a little bit, because it used to be 15 minutes in between picks. Now they've moved it down to 10 in the first round. And it just seems like everything moves along a little bit more efficiently.
I tune in if it's like an Arkansas player. Like, I like seeing whenever but like, there's the part of the draft where you start just, I don't know, at least for me, I start tuning out and I just start checking it on my phone. Like, I don't care to sit there and watch the broadcast.
Oh, we're different this way.
Oh, man.
Do you prefer, when you are watching, do you prefer the pro people, or do you prefer what ABC has done, where they've got Kirk Herbstreit and Desmond Howard and basically the College Game Day set talking about them as college players?
I'd rather, I don't watch it as much as you, clearly. I watch the first round, I'd say, on TV, and after that, I don't watch it, but it sounds better to watch the college guys.
Again,
enjoy that more.
We're different. I give me Mel Kiper and that bunch.
Yeah, I'm just not
different strokes here.
I do got to clarify, Isaac Tesla, it was not WAR. I don't know why I got those letters in my head. It was RAS, RAS.
That stands for?
Relative Athletic Score. A 9.97. It was the 11th best out of 3,441 receivers from 1987 to 2025. So he's freaky athletic. That's what you got to know.
I bet we see the RAS score come up whenever he gets drafted this weekend.
Yep.
All right. We appreciate you being here. Again, Bubba Carpenter going to be in studio with us tomorrow to talk Razorback baseball, what we learned from this series against Little Rock, and looking ahead and forward to this weekend series against Florida in SEC play. Hope we see you then, or at our website, wholehogsports.com. Have a great day, everybody.